Welcome to today's Hinckley Forum. My name is Mary, and I'll be hosting today's forum. The Hinckley Institute was founded in 1965 through a generous bequest of Robert H. Hinckley and the Nobel Foundation. The Institute is dedicated to the idea of teaching students respect for practical politics and the principles of citizen involvement in government. The Hinckley Institute offers paid and unpaid internships to students of all majors here at the U, locally in Washington, D.C., and in 35 countries around the globe. The Hinckley Institute also offers classes, the nation's only campaign management minor, week-long experiences in Washington, D.C., and over $70,000 in academic scholarships. We invite students to go next door or to our website at www.hinckley.utah.edu for more information. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Chris Simon, who's a professor of political science and the director of the MPA program here at the U.
I would begin by saying thank you to Hinckley Institute, to the program Ethnic Studies program, to the Vice President for Equity and Diversity, and to the MPA program for co-sponsoring this event. I would like to introduce Carlos Guevara-Amon, our speaker today. Carlos Guevara-Amon is a policy advisor at the Regional Bureau for Latin America and the Caribbean of the United Nations World Food Program. He received his PhD in Government and International Studies at the University of Notre Dame. He is the author of Panamanian Militarism, A Historical Interpretation, which was published at the Ohio University Center for International Studies in 1996. And he's also the author of Political Careers, Corruption, and Impunity, Panama's Assembly, 1984 to 2009, which was published in 2011 by University of Notre Dame Press. A columnist for La Prensa, which is a newspaper in Panama, Dr. Guevara-Amon served as an assistant for the Panamanian Minister for Foreign Relations between 1999 and 2002. He has edited two volumes on international food security and has contributed articles on Latin American politics to academic journals, including Global Society, Revista de Ciencia Política in Chile, and Revista Panamá de Politica, among others. In spring 2010, he was a visiting fellow at the Helen Kellogg Institute for International Studies at the University of Notre Dame, and he was adjunct professor. He's an adjunct professor at Florida State University, Panama. He has taught summer sessions also at University Studies Abroad Consortium programs at Torino, Italy, and also San Sebastian, Spain. So without further ado, Dr. Guevara-Amon.
Thank you very much for this kind introduction. I'm delighted to be here today, despite the bitter winter weather, to which I'm not used as of late. I did undergo or experience bitter winter weather when I was a graduate student at the University of Notre Dame, but that was a while ago. So it's good, in a sense, it's good to be back in this weather, just for a bit. I am deeply grateful to the university, to the Hinckley Institute, and to the sponsors of this event for the invitation that I received, and especially to Dr. Simon, my colleague at the University of Nevada a few years back, my colleague, a special colleague, a special friend, and a special mentor as well. We've been friends and colleagues for a number of years, and I value his expertise, his collegiality, his knowledge very much. So when Chris invited me to speak to you about my work at, actually about the World Food Program and my work there, I was delighted and immediately accepted. This is a great opportunity, a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful moment, and I hope to be able to provide some information about the program and its work fighting hunger worldwide. It'll be basically a descriptive lecture today. As a UN official, I need to be careful about my remarks. But I hope to provide you some information about the program, its work worldwide, its origins, its connections to U.S. foreign policy, and the implications and relevance of its work in our world today. So I thought of starting with actually not is this how
we now?
Sorry? This one. Yes. I think this might be a good start. Okay. The World Food Program and other UN agencies deal with food security. And food security is an important concept in humanitarian affairs and in world affairs today. Food security refers to access by all peoples at all times to food that is safe, nutritious, and culturally acceptable. Okay, so that is basically the idea of food security, and it is a goal for everyone throughout the world. The World Food Program is concerned with food security, particularly with fighting hunger, because, as you know, hunger it undermines food security. The concern with food security and with hunger have to do with a number of reasons. First of all, hunger is morally unacceptable, and I think we might all identify with that. Hunger is, according to the UN and its specialized agencies, hunger is preventable. Hunger is something that we can avoid with the resources that exist in today's world. So those are reasons for combating hunger and for fighting it. But also, hunger has implications for a country's socioeconomic development. Okay, there's this notion, which is important and which is a developing notion, that hunger naturally undermines social capital. Okay, hunger prevents persons from developing fully, from reaching their physical and their cognitive potential. And as such, it has an impact on human capital. So these are reasons why many agencies, including UN agencies and governments and NGOs and other entities, are interested in combating hunger for its moral implications and for its socioeconomic implications as well. So WFP works to promote food security in situations of hunger, either under emergencies, in emergency situations, or in situations of chronic hunger. And I'll go into that in a minute. The World Food Program focuses particularly on malnutrition, and within malnutrition, on one variety of malnutrition, or one aspect of malnutrition, which is undernutrition. Malnutrition encompasses both undernutrition, which is when individuals do not get the sufficient nutrients they need to lead a healthy life, and overnutrition as well, or better still, obesity or overweight. Okay, malnutrition is the encompassing concept for bad or poor nutrition. It may reflect in overnutrition or obesity or undernutrition, and the World Food Program focuses on undernutrition. Obesity and overweight are the purview of other agencies, including the World Health Organization, which pays attention to this, and we'll go into that in a second, because overweight is also an important health problem, not only in affluent countries such as the United States, and I'm sure that you're all aware of this, that overweight and obesity is an important problem in this country, which causes chronic disease later on, but also in societies transitioning from excuse me, more traditional ways to more modern ways, and countries that are adopting Western ways very rapidly. These countries are also that are undergoing this transition also have obesity problems. But anyway, the World Food Program focuses on undernutrition. And here, this slide shows you the brain of a three-year-old child a three-year-old child that has been normally fed and has the nutrients that, he or she may need. And the image below is the image of the brain of a malnourished three-year-old child, and you can see the differences in size and in obvious development. Okay, so undernutrition is a main concern of the World Food Programme, and undernutrition is measured by a couple of indicators. The one we use most is chronic undernutrition or stunting, which is basically low height per age. And as you may be aware of, as you may know, there are certain standard heights for certain ages, and these are compiled and put together by medical centers and medical institutions. And whenever a child does not reach a certain height, the child may be stunted or under height, and that might be an indication of poor nutrition. Okay, so this is the indicator we focus on. Other agencies focus on other indicators, such as, for example, low weight per age or low weight per height. Low weight per height, by the way, is an indicator of acute undernutrition, which is a situation in which a person is in serious risk of death owing to undernutrition. Chronic undernutrition does not lead to immediate death, but it does lead to other medical conditions that undermine health. As the slide shows, malnutrition is the single largest contributor to disease, and undernutrition is an important contributor to diseases especially among children. Chronic undernutrition is measured among children under 5 years of age. So when we get statistics such as a 20% or a 10% or a 25% chronic undernutrition rate, what that means is that 20% of the child population up to 5 years of age is chronically undernourished. Okay, and this is an important indicator that tells us what the nutritional situation of a society looks like. Okay, so this generally tells us, or what I just addressed, gives us the general picture of what is it that the World Food Programme deals with. Now, I want to talk a little bit about the history of the World Food Programme, because I think this is interesting, especially for a U.S. audience. And it is interesting because it points to a tradition of multilateralism that is part of the U.S. foreign policy, the history of U.S. foreign policy. There's those of you who study or have studied international relations might be familiar with this. There's a clear tendency, a clear tradition of unilateralism in U.S. foreign policy, but there's also one of a clear tradition of multilateralism, that is, working together with other countries in on a basis of equality to pursue certain ends, okay? And the United Nations generally, which was a U.S. initiative, going back to the mid-1940s, the end of the Second World War, and the World Food Programme are both U.S. initiatives. U.S. initiatives, U.S. multilateral initiatives, ideas put forth by the U.S. government to operate as multilateral agencies or activities. So back in the 1960s, in 1960, last full year of his presidency, President Eisenhower addressed the UN General Assembly to suggest the creation of multilateral food distribution fund to address problems of food insecurity throughout the world. And in April of the next year, President Kennedy announced the creation at FAO, the Food and Agriculture Organization, of a temporary program that would deal with food emergencies when they arose. This temporary program was supposed to last for 3 years. So later that year, there was a FAO conference, and later on, the UN General Assembly approved the creation of this temporary program, which started work in 1962, and it quickly had challenges to address. Its first challenges were an earthquake in Iran and floods in Thailand in 1962, and after that, a couple other emergencies. So in 1965, it was decided that the program would continue on a permanent basis. And since then, the World Food Program has existed as an autonomous agency of the United Nations, as a specialized agency of the United Nations, working alongside FAO and the International Food and Agricultural Development Agency, as one of the three specialized food security agencies of the United Nations, based in Rome. Nowadays, the World Food Programme is the leading global agency providing humanitarian support against hunger. In 2012, WFP assisted approximately 90 million people throughout the world. And the expectation for 2013 is to assist approximately 75 million people throughout the world with a budget of approximately $5.5 billion. These are very, very specialized operations that require a lot of logistical effort, significant logistical effort behind them, because oftentimes they occur, as I said before, in situations of humanitarian emergency. So at the moment, the main operations of the World Food Program are taking place in places of humanitarian crisis such as Syria, the Sahel in West Africa, including Mali, which, as many of you might be aware, is undergoing civil strife lately, and since last Friday, an intervention by the French army, Somalia, Afghanistan, Iraq. Okay, these places are places of areas or countries where there's serious humanitarian issues going on, and these are the main areas of intervention by WFP at the moment. But WFP, the World Food Program, also deals with situations of chronic hunger or situations of structural poverty where there is chronic hunger and undernutrition. So basically, it's two main circumstances that cause or that trigger a participation or an intervention by WFP. One is an emergency situation. Emergency situations might be caused by natural events such as earthquakes or floods or tidal waves, tsunamis, like the great and huge Indonesian tsunami of a couple of years ago, droughts. That type of situation, such as the drought in the Sahel or the drought in the Horn of Africa, but also man-made or political emergencies, such as the ones that I alluded to before, the one in Syria, the one in Iraq, the one in Afghanistan, situations stemming from civil strife. All those are emergency situations, okay? And WFP participates in emergency situations to try to assist people gain access to food, because gaining access to food becomes a priority under these emergency situations. The other set of circumstances under which WFP operates are situations of chronic hunger in context of structural poverty. There might not be an emergency. There might not be a natural event that has triggered a humanitarian emergency, but the structural situations of the country or of the area, of the region, are such that people are chronically undernourished and are suffering from hunger. And WFP also participates in those contexts. Okay, let's move ahead a bit. I mentioned this earlier. I did not mention the number of hungry people worldwide, and this is very important. According to FAO's most recent estimate, in 2010-2012, the number of hungry people throughout the world was estimated at 868 million. So that's a bit more than 10%, maybe 11% of the total global population, given that we reached the 7 billion benchmark last year, in the fall of last year, maybe around September of last year, we reached the 7 billion threshold. So 868, almost 900 million people is a bit over 10%. 10% of the people worldwide are hungry, go hungry, and this is a huge number, especially taking into account that there's, according to the United Nations, there's sufficient resources worldwide to be able to ensure that everybody has enough to eat. And this is important to take into account, because some people oftentimes say or hold that there's just not enough food or that resources are not enough, resources are not sufficient. The United Nations holds and maintains that there are enough resources to feed and to ensure that everybody has access to food security. An important point to take into consideration in this regard is the amount of food that is wasted. An FAO report issued a couple of months ago estimates that at least one-third of food production worldwide is discarded. One-third of the total food production worldwide is discarded. In less developed countries, it is discarded on account of poor transportation systems, poor storage systems, and that type of phenomenon. In more affluent societies, it is discarded on account of waste, food being thrown away, either at stores or at homes of people, because people either get more food than they can consume, or they do not calculate carefully what it is that they need. So think about this for a moment. If one-third of the global food production is lost, if this loss could be reduced, or if food production could be made more efficient, then a much larger number of people could be adequately fed. Okay, so this is something to take into consideration when we think about the 868 million people that FAO estimates are hungry, and that could be adequately taken care of, or whose food security could be adequately taken care of if there was a more efficient management of food resources worldwide. There was a report, in addition to this FAO report that I mentioned to, that claims that one-third of the global food production is lost. There was one recent report, and this was only a couple of days ago, and I saw this in the paper in passing as I was coming here. Some think tank in Great Britain estimates that the food loss is even higher than one-third. Okay? So, like I said, this is something that we should probably take into account. Okay, so the World Food Program operates to reduce food insecurity among this huge number of people that are undernourished. It does it through voluntary donations, and this is the next slide. This gives you more or less an idea of where these donations come from. There's no fees in the World Food Program. Countries, member countries, do not contribute fees as they do for the UN Secretariat or for other organizations, other international organizations. The World Food Program operates based on contributions, as you see, this information is at mid-December, about a month ago. The main contributor to the World Food Program continues to be the United States, followed by Canada. So I think it is interesting that the U.S., that the World Food Program was a U.S. initiative, and that the United States continues today to provide most of the funding for the World Food Program. And then there's other countries as well, Canada, the European Commission, the United Kingdom, Japan, Australia, Germany, Sweden, and Brazil. But as you see, the difference between the other countries and the U.S. is significant, is pronounced. I mentioned before the main areas, some of the main areas where humanitarian emergencies are taking place now, and these include Syria and the Sahel, as we mentioned before. These are areas in which the WFP and other UN agencies are actively working to try to protect the humanitarian situation of the population, especially in the case of WFP through promoting food security. But now I'd like to talk a little bit about Latin America and the Caribbean, because that is the area where I work in, and I think we can get some interesting insights by focusing on this, on this region. Latin America has not, and the Caribbean has not been, except for example, the Haitian earthquake in 2010, or recent floods and droughts. There's an ongoing drought in Central America at the moment, but it. Recently, in recent years, it has not been the setting for very dramatic emergencies such as those as we see in Africa or the Middle East. However, hunger is an enduring problem in Latin America. The number of hungry people in Latin America has declined. FAO estimates that number at 49 million persons throughout the region in Latin America and the Caribbean. And this has dropped from the previous estimate, which was 53 million people in 2008-2010. So the number has dropped, but still it is high. And an important point to consider in the case of Latin America and the Caribbean is that many countries in the region, or most countries, all of them except Haiti, are considered middle-income countries, okay? So as such, they don't generally or normally qualify for foreign aid. But these countries have very pronounced disparities within them. So while a country might have overall good macroeconomic statistics, good economic performance, and as you many of you might know, Latin America overall has had a fairly good economic performance in the past few years despite the global crisis. So despite this generally positive macroeconomic situation, there are pockets of poverty and food insecurity and hunger lingering in many of the countries. In fact, today's editorial, today was the day that I had to publish my editorial, every other Wednesday, and today was a Wednesday when it was my turn to publish, and I focused precisely on this issue, and I focused on this issue with a look at Panama, the situation in Panama. Panama has had the strongest economic growth in all the region, okay? It was 11% last year, and one of the strongest growth rates in the world, okay? And this has been sustained for the past few years. Per capita income has increased significantly to the point that Panama is now considered classified in the middle income countries segment, and at the higher end of that middle-income country segment, and its GDP is larger than countries with GDP per capita is larger than that of countries with many more resources, such as Venezuela or Brazil or even Mexico. Okay, however, we have a situation in which there is a very prosperous economy coexisting simultaneously with a social situation that needs attention, okay? And you may recall that I referred to the chronic undernutrition rate or the rate of stunting. The rate of stunting in Panama, according to the last household surveys, and these are surveys that are conducted under World Bank auspices, which measure, among other things, among other variables or among other phenomena, stunting. According to the last household survey, which was conducted in 2008, Panama's stunting rate among children under 5 is 20%. Okay? So, you have a country in which has had impressive economic growth with a lot of wealth generated in recent years, in fact, a lot of wealth generated over the past 20 years since the country moved to democracy, coexisting with a social situation in which 1/5 of all children under 5 are undernourished, okay, are chronically undernourished. And Panama is an example of this, which happens in Latin America, which occurs in Latin America in most countries. Perhaps the most dramatic case is not Haiti, which always comes to mind. Haiti is the single country in the Western Hemisphere that does not classify as a middle income country. It classifies as a lower income country, and it always comes to mind when we speak about or when we talk about social conditions. But the most dramatic case is not Haiti. The most dramatic case of hunger and undernutrition in Latin America is Guatemala. And this is not something that we normally think about. In Guatemala, the overall chronic undernutrition rate is 50%. Okay, that means that half the children overall. Okay, overall. Remember, these statistics are taken as averages for the country. Okay, so overall, in Guatemala, which is a country of 12 or 13 million people, half the children under 5 are stunted, are undernourished, and in some areas. Okay, some areas, some especially indigenous areas, the rate of undernutrition goes as high as 80%. Okay, so this is these are rates that you find in other continents and other regions. You don't associate with Latin America, especially because, as I said before, the economic performance of Latin America has been overall generally good over the past few years. So one would expect that with more economic growth and with better economic conditions and with more prosperous economies, these situations would be addressed. But that is not always the case. So that is why WFP works in Latin America not only to address emergencies when they might occur, droughts, as I said before, droughts or floods or inundations or earthquakes, but also to address situations of structural poverty and chronic hunger, as those that I described in Guatemala, in Panama, in other places that have been ongoing for many, many years and that have not been addressed by improving economic conditions. Okay? So, you might ask, which are the main... well, this is important too, and I will go over this briefly. There's 11 countries in the region where the World Food Program has interventions. Bolivia, Colombia, Cuba, the Dominican Republic, Ecuador, El Salvador, Guatemala, Haiti, Honduras, Nicaragua, and Peru. And in addition to that, if a country or a government requests assistance from the WFP, the program intervenes or participates in whatever effort the government requests. It is important to note that as a specialized agency of the United Nations, the World Food Program can only operate when it is invited or authorized by the national government, okay? So this is important to bear in mind. Of all these countries, as I said before, the more serious cases of undernutrition occur in Guatemala and also Haiti, Haiti and Honduras and Bolivia, but especially in Guatemala. There's certain priorities in Latin America, and I will go over this briefly. The priorities are basically to help governments improve their social safety nets in order to address food insecurity, to help governments improve their disaster preparedness, their preparation against natural disasters and the resilience in situations of natural disasters, and to promote and stimulate smallholder agriculture, also as a response to food insecurity, as a policy that can help improve conditions of food security throughout the region. Let me just end and finalize, because I've taken more time than I wanted to, and I would like to address questions if there are any questions. Let me just finalize by saying a bit more concretely what it is, which are the interventions that WFP carries out at the request of national governments in some of these countries to address food insecurity. In the case of emergencies, basically, the World Food Program, what the World Food Program does is distribute food. Okay, basically that is what is needed in situations of emergency, and that involves complex logistics. But the main intervention is, food distribution directly to affected persons. In conditions of chronic hunger and structural poverty, as I said before, there's certain interventions that can help alleviate and revert these conditions. For example, maternal and child health programs are very important. Okay, these programs are implemented through clinics, and they basically consist of providing mothers at medical controls, ensuring that they attend medical controls, and providing them at medical controls with the nutrients that they need in order to carry on their pregnancies in a healthy way, and raise and rear their babies in a healthy way. So they receive the necessary nutrients that they need during pregnancy and during lactation. Of course, during the first 6 months of age, the most important and most efficient intervention for infants is maternal breastfeeding. But mothers need to have the adequate conditions in order to provide breastfeeding. So that is why these maternal and child health interventions are crucial and are essential to prevent chronic hunger from affecting children from the time that they are infants. Okay, once a child is affected by chronic insecurity, it is very difficult to revert those conditions later on. Even if the child receives adequate nourishment, adequate nutrition later on, the damage that chronic undernutrition at an early stage does to the child is very difficult to revert. Okay, so maternal and child health interventions are crucial. There's also after breastfeeding, there's intervention for infants up to the time when they are ready to go to school, and they are provided with the food that they need and the nutrition that they need, the micronutrients that they need, in these interventions, which also take place through health centers. School feeding programs are one of the classic interventions that WFP carries out, because not only does it fulfill the interests or the objectives of providing food and nourishment to school children, but it also meets other expectations and other objectives. It attracts children to school, which is important to develop their human capital. It contributes to providing or ensuring that their medical situation is being controlled and monitored. it contributes to involving parents in the children's school programs. Sometimes food is bought, food for these programs is acquired in the local community, thus fostering local agricultural production. So these are very, very effective interventions that not only target one aspect, but various aspects of food security and social conditions. There's conditional transfer programs as well, which are very much favored by the international financial institutions these days. And these conditional transfer programs transfer funds directly to qualifying families, provided that they meet certain conditions. For example, that they take their children to regular medical controls, or that they enroll their children in school, or that they provide some service to the community. So these conditional transfer programs, which can be cash-based or they can be in-kind programs as well, are also interventions that aim at promoting food security. One program that has been recently implemented is this Purchase for Progress program, which involves stimulating local agricultural production and acquiring agricultural production from local producers to utilize in these food security interventions. The World Food Program and other agencies acquire a large amount of foodstuffs to distribute in their interventions. So the idea behind it is that if these foodstuffs can be acquired from local producers, this will be not only a boost this will operate as a boost to the producers' own food security and to the development of agriculture in these local communities. So these are some of the interventions that are carried out in order to promote food security in Latin America and in other countries throughout the world. And I think I'll leave it at that, because I think I've spoken for long enough. And if there are any questions or if there's anything I can clarify, I'll be glad to stay on for a couple of minutes and try to address that. So thank you. Yes.
In areas of civil unrest like Syria, what kind of security are you provided with?
There is it's more than one UN agency or UN organization that participates. It's a joint effort by many UN agencies, and security is one of the aspects that they coordinate. Each agency has its security monitors and its security personnel, and they coordinate it jointly. But it is, as you might imagine, it is a tricky, and difficult situation. Normally, all sides in conflict tend to respect the UN. But there are instances in which they don't, and that is lamentable, and that has to be taken care of. Yes.
What efforts does the World Food Program?
I'm sorry, can't hear you.
Oh, yeah. What efforts does the World Food Program attempt to develop with private enterprises?
That's a very good point. That's a very good point. WFP. Works in partnership, okay, with various groups, because it can't do all this work on its own. Main partners are always governments. Remember what I said just a minute ago. The organization does not participate or involve itself in any country unless it has the authorization or the invitation of the host government. But so governments are the main partners, but the private sector is also an important partner. The private sector can provide donations. It can provide expertise. It can provide know-how. It can provide human resources in order to carry out some of the missions. And let me give you one example. In some countries, the school meal programs have been modified or amended through partnerships with the private sector so that specialized companies that can carry out this function very efficiently actually do the logistics, implement these programs. So school feeding is an area in which the private sector has participated in some Latin American countries, notably in Chile. Chile, by the way, has the lowest rate of chronic undernutrition anywhere in the hemisphere. It's even lower than the U.S. It's less than 2%. Okay, and in Chile, the private sector has been involved in implementing the school feeding program. WFP doesn't work any longer in Chile, but the point serves to illustrate that the private sector participates and can participate in carrying out some of these interventions efficiently, and it is something that is actively sought after. Yes.
On one of your slides, the World Food Program mandate was expanded to include air transport.
Yeah.
What does that have to do with, besides, obviously agriculture and stuff like that?
That was in 2003 that the World Food Program received that mandate to coordinate all air operations for the United Nations. The main implication is that a significant amount of food and relief is delivered through air operations. So there's areas of difficult access where the only way of accessing these areas is through airlifts. And the World Food Program received the mandate to coordinate these activities back in 2003. Okay. Yes.
Is the World Food Program ever worried that is the World Food Program worried that people will become reliant upon these, and that it's discouraging farmers in these countries from developing and processing more food for the country itself?
That's a very good question, and that is a concern. And this is a trade-off that needs to be assessed, I guess. Because we're dealing with human beings and we're dealing with humanitarian situations. How long should food aid be provided? So there's programs in place to encourage people to move beyond the stage in which they are recipients of food, in order to try to encourage them to regain their livelihoods. This is difficult in cases of severe disruption, such as civil war or natural disasters. But there's programs in place to try and encourage recipients or beneficiaries to try to regain their livelihoods. That's one thing. And then the other thing is a recent shift in the focus of operations, of WFP's operations, from food aid to food assistance. And that also has to do something this also has implications for the issue that you raised. WFP is becoming more and more an agency that provides capacity development and advice and technical advice to governments and other partners in countries, precisely to address this issue, precisely to avoid becoming entangled in a cycle of dependency. Okay, but it is a very difficult issue to assess because how long do people need assistance? Sometimes people need assistance or aid for a long period of time, and this is something that needs careful evaluation and assessment. Yes.
What hinders the growth of WFP to reach like all the people?
Well, reaching all the people I don't think it would be feasible for one single agency. That would not be feasible. Constraints to the operation of the agency include the basic constraint is funding, and funding has seen some problems recently, especially with the European crisis and the economic situation in the United States. So funding would be the main constraint, the main difficulty toward implementing more programs. However, funding has been fairly forthcoming in cases of emergencies, which is encouraging because these are very big humanitarian emergencies, the ones that I mentioned in Syria, in Iraq, in Afghanistan, in the Sahel, in the Horn of Africa, very, very difficult emergencies that need attention. Unfortunately, there's been not sufficient, but support and donations have been forthcoming for those emergencies. Any other question?
I have a question.
Yes.
I'm a biologist, and I've worked a lot in Latin America. I was wondering whether you used sort of a combination of demography and kind of environmental capacity to forecast where there will be problems down the road. And if you do, what are the likely hot spots coming up in the Americas?
Yes, that's central to the work of WFP. There is something called VAM, Vulnerability Analysis and Mapping, VAM. And the World Food Program is very strong on that. That is basically using the tools that you suggested, mapping, environmental mapping, demographic mapping, to try to foresee where humanitarian natural catastrophes might be occurring. Hotspots in Latin America at the moment, the dry corridor in Central America. Okay, this is a corridor stretching from Guatemala to Nicaragua, and this sector, this area is undergoing a drought, and the drought is expected to intensify, and this will have an impact. Is having an impact on the food security of four countries. Guatemala, El Salvador, Honduras, and Nicaragua. The Andes region is also a hot spot, not only on account of conditions of structural poverty, but also because of environmental degradation, on account of the clearing of the forests and of global warming. There's more floods, there's more inundations, the glaciers are becoming depleted, and this is having and will continue to have in the future an impact on the food security of these communities. And then other areas that are disaster prone or that have been identified as areas of as vulnerable areas include island states in the Caribbean because of the rising levels of the ocean and because of recurring, more frequently recurring hurricanes. So if I would have to name three areas, it would be Central America, the Andes, and the Caribbean. And for sure, vulnerability analysis and mapping helps predict to a certain extent which areas are or will be prone to emergencies or will generate emergencies in the near future.
We're going to close at this time. Please join me in expressing our thanks for this excellent and informative forum.
Yes.
Can you donate online?
Yes.
Does it go to, like, the school?